So this the sort of the scope of this workshop is a little alien to me, and indeed I came because I was so envious of all the theorists who have done such great work, and now I'm envious of the experimentalists now that I see what you're up to. And so I was hoping to give, you know, I'd like to give a talk that would be useful to you. I'm not sure that I've done that. I hope it at least is entertaining, okay? So take it at that level. Okay, so just to give you a broad sense of how I view these things, and I think many of the theorists here, we sort of put a lot of money on these two principles, special relativity and quantum mechanics. These are the pillars of our subject, and indeed, the fusion of these gives rise to quantum field theory. Everything goes click in a very beautiful way. We really trust this fusion. Of course, at some point, Einstein also decided to incorporate gravity, taking the equivalence principle of the data at the time as a principle in itself, very, very seriously. And that led, with special relativity, the combination of these elements led to general relativity. Everything clicked into place in a seemingly almost unique way. I'll explain the almost later. So far, everything is going in a kind of dignified procession. When you extrapolate, even very early on, extrapolate general relativity to the whole universe, you find the non-static cosmological space-times and physics playing out there. And of course, in more modern times, with the input of quantum mechanics, it's a great triumph of all the forces combining in vast extrapolations and yet in ways that we can and test again, okay? At shorter distances, putting together general relativity and quantum mechanics is even a conceptually bamboozling problem and has led in many directions. I just point to what I consider one of the highlights of accomplishment that came through the pathway of string theory and quantum field theory, known as the ADS-CFT correspondence. I won't explain any of that here. But it really is capturing many of the puzzles that I think that these two elements force on us when you think about gravity and quantum mechanics at a very fundamental level. Everything so far, very dignified, very polished, and helped a little bit by data in a lot of cases. Cosmology pushes us automatically, as we think through all the problems of the LHC, this, that, and the other, we get into this idea that our universe may only be a patch of a much larger universe, a multiverse, where things look very different. And we are sort of only looking at what our fundamental laws are, like the climate in this multiverse, just some incidental features of a smaller patch of space-time.
Lucky that Neil isn't here.
Sorry?
Lucky that Neil Turak isn't here.
maybe. I thrive on controversy. So I don't know. And then there's the question of anthropic selection and so on. So these are murkier things. I put them in brown to say, you know, they're on a different footing, but certainly our thoughts are dragged in that direction as we agonize over what to do next. A very beautiful thing comes out of ADS-CFT. Again, I won't explain it in great detail, but just say that it makes the idea that relativity, not just special relativity, but even general relativity, could be emergent phenomena. That is, you don't put the metric into the Lagrangian at the start of the day. It's something that comes out. That idea starts to resonate much more with our most fundamental understanding of gravity. And with that idea, whenever an emergent phenomenon comes about, in its best case, in its most interesting case, the emergent properties are not exact. They're approximate. We have many examples of that. Rotational invariance in a crystal may be approximately true at long wavelengths, but it's not exactly true. There are always residuals of the microscopic fact that it's not rotationally invariant. In ADS-CFT, there's sort of a toy example that you can look at that's sort of worked out in that language. Then there's the very fact, in terms of targets of opportunity, that I'd say special relativity, speed of light, constant null reference frames, and quantum mechanics with its own bizarre axioms that none of us truly understands, these are already big question marks. Let's agree that we know how to use these things, but they're very puzzling, and they seem to be vaguely related. The punchline of quantum mechanics entanglement is really only gets its punchline when you put in sort of causality constraints and so on. So So there's something going on there, and maybe there's a deeper story, and we'd love not just to be targeting even very sensible targets of opportunity like axions, but even the crazy things like maybe these ideas are only approximations, okay? We'd like to be able to do that. But we have this question, why should there be any cracks in the most fundamental pillars of our subject now, right? I mean, what's so great now? And so here are some of the fundamental pillars, just to remind you again. And so I just want to make a statement regardless of dark energy, which is that I think it's reasonable when you have tremendous jumps in sensitivity to new regimes that you just go for it, theory independent, and just say, do these ideas extrapolate into completely different territory? Why not check, you know, even without a theory idea? Of course, you know, inflation itself and even pre-bicep, and even bicep too, if you just forget whether it's right or wrong, just what was it aiming at, is an incredible extrapolation of quantum mechanics and general relativity into a completely new terrain. And so anything could have happened. Let's find out what did happen. But anyway, anything could have happened, and all the data we have prior to this point seems to be nicely consistent with inflation, maybe other things. But this is, these vast extrapolations are surely worth pursuing experimentally, even without a sort of direct theory motivation. However, physics certainly thrives in a crisis. And if we look for a crisis related to long-range forces like gravity, the crisis, you know, extraordinaire is the question of dark energy, which is just the name for whatever is accelerating our universe, the expansion of our universe. In general relativity, this dark energy is overly mystical. In general relativity, you can fit the data that we have now with a cosmological constant term, or otherwise known as a vacuum energy density. It's just a constant. And it's the simplest form of dark energy. And after some hiccups, Einstein would have been happy with it. And that's it. Okay. The problem is the magnitude of the effect, which is sort of millielectron volt to the fourth by the data, and yet that's way, way smaller than any particle physics scale that we sort of think of as setting the standard by which we would expect dark energy to have shown up. I'll go into that in a little bit of detail pictorially. So before I do that, I just want to list, you know, this crisis, the cosmological constant problem of understanding this hierarchy, I just want to list what I consider the well worked out solutions, okay, out of which I want you to notice that 20% are mine, okay? So here's the list. Here's the list of all the ones that everybody sort of agrees have a fighting chance of being right. Okay. That's it. So That's why I can't be a great guide for you in any, you know, sort of serious experience. Because this is the set. So you see, we have to somehow open what I call the intellectual aperture a little bit. What I tell my students is take off your glasses if you want to see more. Normally, the template for these, you know, for theory and experiment, the ideal thing is the theoretical mechanism, some dignified thing, and then the experimental template comes with some ingenuity about how to tackle the sort of the theory plot. But we don't have that. We are now down to some sort of loopholes in the cosmological constant problem, some analogies that strike you as resonating with the original problem. And really what you want to do is to let experiments lead the way, because we're really stumped theoretically, other than a sort of anthropically designed fine-tuning, and it's just a cosmological constant and we don't need more data. Other than that perspective, we need to be driven by experiments, given sort of the theoretical record up till now. But all we can do is continue the rest of the talk with a little bit of this, okay? So I apologize for that. First of all, let's try to understand the problem, because there's something dignified about the problem. The reason we have so few solutions is because the problem is tight. So it's good to have a pictorial sense of why it's tight, okay? And so I'm gonna just say it in this way, okay? It's related to the uncertainty principle. So here is the whirl line of a planet, which for me is just the source of some gravitational field, okay? So this is a space-time picture of the planet and whirl line. Here is the whirl line of the particles that are inside an atom that might be feeling the gravitational pull of the planet. So there they are, okay? And this is the new beast. It's sort of vacuum energy written the way a Feynman diagrammatician would draw it. And basically, what it looks like is it looks like you started with nothing, and then there's particle creation. And particle creation normally costs you E equals mc squared. That's what particle creation normally does. But with the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, as long as you destroy anything you created in a short period of time, you can do it. And so, if you like, pictorially, space-time is populated by these bubbles of quantum fluctuations, courtesy of Heisenberg. Okay? Now, the gravitational field, if it couples this way, it pulls on the atom. The gravitational field, if it couples to all of this stuff, which is populating, bubbling out through the vacuum, would be like a cosmological constant. It would cause planets, stars, everything to get pulled apart from each other. Okay? So we want to understand the distinction in these two sides of the picture. We can do that by going into the thought. I'm sort of following along the Hillary Clinton foreign policy primer here. So here is the thought process of these soft gravitational fields. This one says, should I couple to this pathetic little virtual photon that's holding the electron to the proton? And it says, I better, because that tiny little binding energy, well, they're awfully sensitive, these equivalence principle tests. I better couple to that guy. Okay, so that's that decision. What about this guy? He looks at something that seems like a sort of little that little box of space-time looks sort of similar. But I don't want to couple to that, because then the universe starts accelerating like crazy. Okay, so should I, shouldn't I? Okay, dilemma. And indeed, this little space-time window in which it has to make the distinction between am I looking at this or am I looking at this, this is the problem that built into all the formalism of general relativity, Feynman diagram, you name it, is the fact that however soft the gravitational field, that's about the wave function of the graviton. Okay? But the graviton itself is a point particle, just like the electron. And these couplings, in standard theory, are point-like. And a point-like thing, you have a tiny infinitesimal window in which the soft graviton or the graviton has to make a decision, couple or not, couple or not. And unfortunately, these two windows look the same in that, okay? It's only sort of from a vast perspective that they look different. So indeed, this soft gravitational field would have to couple to vacuum energy because it can't distinguish it from just the kind of stuff you want it to couple to. And that is the cosmological constant problem, because these kind of vacuum energy densities are typical of particle physics, TEV. Okay, so here's where soft power comes in. If only we could not have the particle, the graviton, be very point-like. If for some reason, this is just a loophole, I don't know what, I don't know what the theory is, as I'll say in the next slide, but if a graviton coupling was spread out over some distance in space-time, some distance scale L, it wasn't a point, then it could take the viewpoint of this L-sized box in space-time. And an L-sized box in space-time can distinguish by saying, I've completely enclosed this vacuum bubble versus, no, there's stuff coming in from early times and going out to late times. So there is basically a way, a hope in hell, that a very intelligent graviton, given enough time and space, could make the decision with some brilliant mechanism that it ought not to couple to this and should keep this. If that's the case, then since it's the smallest bubbles that give the largest contributions to vacuum energy, that's the usual energy distance relationship, the vacuum energy you get is sort of cut off by this distance L. So you only get 1 over L to the fourth. This is schematically how it works in string theory, where the graviton is really a string of size L string, and all the gravitational phenomena take place over L string size units of space-time.
If bicep 2 happens to be correct, and
yes,
we really think with 10 to the 16 GeV energy densities, how does that...
Let me say it in a second. So that's what you'll see it on this slide coming up. So this idea of a fat graviton is simply to say that in order to fit the data naturally, you'd like this size over which the graviton acts, or maybe the size of the graviton itself, to be order tens of microns in order to naturally get the right size of vacuum energy, 1 over L to the 4th. Okay. What's special here is that would mean that the size of the graviton, in whatever sense this box tells you, that size is much bigger than the distances on which we test the pointiness of matter. Okay. That is not a standard string theory. We don't have a concrete model of that. All it is a loophole in the statement of the problem. And the only thing we can do is to ask the experiment to go into that loophole and close it or discover something. Okay? So how do you test whether there is an L grav of order tens of microns or not? Test Newton's law. If it continues unabated, then that's 1 over r squared. But 1 over r squared is getting sharper and sharper wavelengths as you go to smaller distances. If, in fact, small distances are being sort of screened out, you'd expect something more like this, a shutoff of gravity. Okay? Just for comparison, when people talk about extra dimensions, then large extra dimensions, that's something that's growing even faster. Okay? So to answer Suji's question, you see, this is how weak the situation is. One should note every problem, and I'm noting it. Inflation would have to be more complicated. One of the simplest ideas, which would resonate with somebody trying to escape axions and bicep, is simply that this fundamental scale could be a function of scale factor, et cetera, et cetera. That's over-dignifying how miserable the situation is. And yet, miserable theory does not mean that this is a dumb place to look experimentally, because it's the loophole in making the case that the problem is a problem. So go find out. Okay, second plot. Why not use a symmetry? Don't we use symmetries for all things that we want to be small or zero? Just use a symmetry. So this is a very cute thing that can be drawn in pictures. That's why I want to go through it. And then you get also a punchline and a direction for experiment. So here, I'm going to do quantum field theory the way that Dirac did, which is very pictorially. Here is the Dirac equation. Here is the usual dispersion relation. And of course, he was surprised to find he did actually have negative energy states and positive energy states in this set of available states. But he had a trick. He used the Fermi statistics to say, let me imagine that the Dirac C is full. So all the electron states here are occupied. And all of the electron states here are not occupied in the vacuum. And that's the picture of the quantum field theorist's picture of the vacuum. There's a bosonic version of this, and I won't go through it. Okay? So this is the picture of the vacuum. And it's a very beautiful picture of how you create pairs of particles. Okay? A positron is nothing but a hole in the Dirac C. Since these are negative energy states, a hole is actually positive energy. And here is an electron. So if you have enough, if you have this much energy, you can kick this state and move the guy here up to here, and you would perceive it as an electron-positron pair. Okay. Now, where's the vacuum energy that we're all worried about? The vacuum energy is the energy of all of these filled electrons sitting here. Okay, and maybe there's cancellations against other species of particles way down here, particles beyond the Standard Model. But at least we're looking at some very, very large contribution to vacuum energy. Now, here's a new idea. Suppose you take another species of particle. There it is. But you do something seemingly dumb. Instead of filling this Dirac C, you fill the Dirac sky. Okay. If you do that, then that setup is called a ghost. Okay. So this is a ghost vacuum. And the vacuum energy is now all of this stuff. It comes with the opposite sign. Okay. So pursuing a sort of classical idea of Linde's, Kaplan and I proposed this thing called a discrete symmetry between a ghost species and us, which is literally a dumb symmetry, that you just take the Standard Model and replicate it, but in some sense use the ghost vacuum. And so you can think of that as something called energy parity, which just says that if you turn your head like this, it's the same as looking like this. Okay? And of course, then algebraically, vacuum energy cancels. Even though there's very large vacuum energy here, it cancels against this. Okay? So that's the dumb basic idea. However, you might say there's something sort of unstable about this, that things could fall down. And but you see, nobody knows what down is unless the two sectors are coupled to each other. So if they're not coupled to each other, each of them thinks that they are oriented the right way.
But they're always coupled to the right.
Exactly. So let me just, so the logical limit where they're decoupled, this is a perfectly stable ground state. And you can even set up very simple, you know, condensed matter spin chain like systems to have states like this and so on. There's nothing wrong. It's very concrete at this level. But as Maxime says, gravity must couple to both of them, because the whole point is that this vacuum energy is canceling against this vacuum energy. Okay, so that's the idea. And as soon as there's something that couples both sectors, you can imagine vacuum decay. What would vacuum decay look like? It would be keeping these two pictures and changing them slightly like this. With conservation of energy, you could just do this, where the 2mc squared necessary to bump a particle from the C into the sky cancels against the negative energy to bump a particle from the sky into the sea. Okay? And so suddenly this vacuum is getting corrupted. So we should find out what the rate is. And you can do it, you can try to set it up in terms of Feynman diagrams, except nothing turns into garbage, right? That's the diagram. And in these kind of diagrams, relative to decay rate diagrams you've ever seen, there's one extra integral in phase space, which is the overall rest frame of the state coming out. Okay? And because that integral over the overall rest frame is non-compact, you can have arbitrarily large boosts, you always get infinity for the decay rate as long as Lorentz invariance is true. Okay. So there's only one way this dumb plot can make any sense, and that is if relativity is emergent, by which I mean at short enough distances you have Lorentz violation that cuts off this boost integral. But under ordinary working conditions to a higher degree, you have relativity as usual. Okay. Indeed, you can ask, what is sort of the cutoff, since gravity is the guy mediating this and gravity gets stronger in the UV, that should turn into some sort of cutoff on where gravity behaves as usual. Okay. And so these guys, studying a related problem, found that so this looks just like, maybe you don't see this stuff, but this stuff you see. And so this looks like cosmic rays coming out of nowhere. And so they put a bound on this of a few MeV. That means gravity misbehaves on short distances beyond perhaps what any of us are experimentally planning to do. But the bound is sort of on these sort of changes in the diffuse gamma rays spectrum of the sky or something, okay? You might also, so people have, again, alluded to sort of thinking of weird ways in which antimatter might behave in gravitational fields and so on. And I think the answer is no, it behaves, I think we have strong betting odds that it behaves as normal. But these ghosts are a kind of weird antimatter, right? They're very closely related in the way you fill the Dirac C and antimatter. And indeed, they have some bizarre behaviors. The non-relativistic Lagrangian always looks like this, and the sign of M tells you whether you're a particle or a ghost. Okay. So an interesting special case is when one particle is got the same mass as a ghost, but with, of course, opposite signs. So a regular particle and a ghost particle. And so they're sitting there at early times, just sitting there, and they feel gravity, and they just spontaneously move in the direction of the ghost. So it's not like back to back. It's just, okay. So weird things happen when gravity combines with these ghosts. And indeed, you don't want too much of this ghost, just like you don't want too much antimatter today. You really don't want too much of this ghost stuff today. Okay. So you need some mechanism for asymmetrizing the abundances. And there's a beautiful, I won't tell you because I'm running out of time, but there's a beautiful inflation story to tell you why there are fewer ghosts. I mean, negligible numbers of ghosts today than in times past. And indeed, if you look at the record of human fiction, you'll see that that's the case. Okay. So gravity has to decide, gravity is also a quantum field. It has to decide whether to be a ghost or a regular. And that always asymmetrizes this energy parity, which is the defensive parity, the protective parity symmetry. If you, however, say gravity is a very weak effect, then you're okay.
But what about photons? Photons are also, you know, are they ghosts or not?
No, there's a ghost photon and there's us.
Okay.
So with gravity, the scale, this cutoff scale, the same one that seems to roughly come out for cosmic rays, again, seems to do the trick for cutting off this, for making energy parity a good enough symmetry. Okay, so end of that. Lorentz violation in that sense completely changes. People have thought of Lorentz violation for a number of reasons, but Lorentz violation completely changes the robustness of the cosmological constant problem. That's the weakest statement I can make. So in that sense, it's motivated to think about tests of Lorentz invariance. A final analogy for a final experimental frontier, but it's just an analogy, okay? Because it turns out that 100 years ago, there was a second, in fact, it was the first proposal to unify special relativity and equivalence principle and 1 over r squared is the model you would have written if you were not Einstein, which is mostly the case. That was Nordstrom's theory, where the gravitational field is a scalar. Why would you ever think it was anything else? Okay. And Einstein had tremendous difficulties with the equivalence principle and the idea that gravity was a scalar. And he went back and forth with Nordstrom until he perfected it. In fact, it was his first theory of curved spacetime and with Fokker. And it is a beautiful geometric theory of gravity, as I will try to indicate, as beautiful as the real thing, okay? But it, for our purposes, has one interesting feature, that it makes it even more clear with the passage of time that the equivalence principle in this theory should really be thought of rightfully as a kind of emergent phenomenon. An emergent phenomenon need not be exact, and that makes it interesting. Okay, it's much easier to play with the idea of an emergent equivalence principle in this toy model than the real thing, but it could be true about the real thing. Okay, so you can add quantum mechanics, you can update it, you can find out that this mathematically leads you into a very beautiful subject of conformal field theory, and ultimately takes you back to that same ADS-CFT that is the height of our understanding of ordinary gravity, because there were only two paths to unify special relativity and Newton's law and equivalence principle, and they both are tied at the hip. They are closely related. One, however, is easier than the other, and so we look at it. And so you can study deviations from the equivalence principle. Species of particle MI, I mean, ith species of mass, can couple to gravity. It couples like mass over the Planck scale or whatever, G Newton. And then there can be corrections, which are breaking, first, the universality, okay? They're breaking the equivalence principle, but in a very small way. Pathetic. Who cares? Why should we look at it? Because in this scalar theory of gravity, where you can actually work things out honestly, when you look at what dark energy looks like, you find, and times the usual square root of minus g, you find that it looks like a cosmological constant times scale factor to the fourth, which is always implicit. But then there are these sort of epsilonic corrections to the exponent 4. Okay. And once you do that, you find that the scale factor has a sort of almost absolute significance in a very sly way, okay? And this is part of the solution to the scalar version of the cosmological constant problem that was worked out by these guys. And what you find is that this epsilon turns into a multiplicative factor. It says that whatever the cosmological constant you thought as a theorist you should have got, you'll get epsilon smaller. Okay. So if epsilon is some many orders of magnitude small number, then you can suppress the cosmological constant through a simple, elegant mechanism. But it'll cost you. It's going to cost you in terms of very small deviations from the equivalence principle. If there's questions afterwards, I'll tell you that it's really, really small. But it suggests by analogy how, you know, let's not take the analogy too seriously, but let's take the moral, which is very small dv. There's a loophole in the cosmological constant problem because there is an input to the cosmological constant problem. It's called the equivalence principle. As soon as we have even small breaks in the equivalence principle, there may be small breaks in solar system tests, and they can have gargantuan effects on the scale of the universe. Okay, that's the moral. And so maybe we should look for very small deviations in the equivalence principle, anomalous accelerations and the like. Okay, it could also have, as I said, order one impact on gravity at the largest length scales, including structure on the largest length scales. For example, a classic test of dark energy is the so-called equation of state parameter, which normally is meant to be minus one in, for a cosmological constant. Here you would get, for reasons I won't explain, something like 1 over log epsilon. And if this epsilon is the 10 to the 120 orders of magnitude that we are all worried about, that turns into a percent deviation. That is a reasonable goal for such dark energy tests, except I've been talking about a world that doesn't exist, scalar gravity. Okay, but these are morals for the real world. So I'm going to stop. But basically, dark energy, let me say the bad news. Okay, dark energy may well be an overly mystical word for a very simple thing, a cosmological constant, very possibly tuned for reasons beyond our, you know, ability to diagnose, or maybe the anthropic principle. And it's quite possible that general relativity is very standard. This is the dignified, it's the right thing to do, okay? And there's lots of other incredibly rich physics that has been discussed at this workshop, which could be long wavelength, it's perfectly sane, and it's incredibly interesting, okay? So that's true. But if you're more ambitious, there may be a deep mechanism behind dark energy at work. I've tried to give you sketches of what might pass for one. Theory is still poor. Experiments, however, can probe short distance gravity. It can probe Lorentz violation in all its many guises. It can probe equivalence principle violation if we're careful about what that means. It can look at things like the dark equation energy of state, equation of state, or how well we understand the largest structures in the universe. Okay, and maybe there are more things like that. And so my hope is, at best, it must be an experiment that leads the way. Okay, I'll stop there.
Questions? All right, I have a question for Stefan.
Can you be a bit more specific about what the violation of an equivalence principle you have in mind? You know, there are several versions of the equivalence principle in gravity, weak, and strong. So I would like from you a bit more precise definition.
So there are a few. Let me just say a couple, okay? And then we can talk afterwards.
Constant gravity, for example, is the only other theory together with GR that satisfies a strong equivalence principle.
Yes.
So
yeah.
It's very important from this.
Yes. Definition. So, but Nordstrom gravity, the gravity that then is perfected in the Einstein-Fokker paper, it has a perfect equivalence principle.
Right.
What they did not realize, because they didn't have the advantage of quantum field theory, et cetera, is that that is just a special case of a slightly more general structure where the equivalence principle is which perturbs their theory, and where the equivalence principle is not exact. It's almost exact, but there's a small deviation from it. So that's something that people 100 years ago could not understand, but is true. Okay? And the kind of deviations are the ones that I'm showing here, which would turn into, for example, it would look in like sort of anomalous accelerations of, you know, test bodies in gravitational fields. That's sort of one thing that could happen. The other is much more like a graviton mass. Suppose there's a graviton mass whose Compton wavelength is not too different from the size of our universe. Then you might say, oh, well then for most things, small distance tests, I might not notice. But when you get out to distances of order the size of the universe, this will not be a small effect. It'll be 100% effect, okay? So that's where things like the dark energy equation of state and so on become sensitive probes of violations of the equivalence principle. In some sense, for the sort of cosmologists, this idea of a scale factor showing up, the scale factors are always relative factors. The absolute value of the scale factor is meaningless if you have exact equivalence principle. The fact that here there's some sort of notion of an absolute scale factor is again a violation of the equivalence principle. So there are different faces to the violation of the equivalence principle in different regimes, which is what makes it interesting. But I could easily, I could show you a little offline, in a Lagrangian. Look, there's the equivalence principle. Here's this extra term. That's the breaking of it. And then we can break it up into all its sort of more phenomenological guises.
Questions? Misha? Yeah, in your picture of cosmological term, can you show that it is repulsion, actually?
That depends on the ultimate sign. You mean this picture? Yeah. Here, in the end, there are many such contributions, and ultimately you depend on their plus and minus signs all over the place, and so you don't get a prediction at that level. If you had a very sharp ultraviolet theory, like a particular string theory and a particular string theory compactification, then you can actually compute these kind of diagrams at leading order, if you're a finite human.
You said that, graviton is looking at this small...
Yes.
And so the sign is there in this small box, isn't it?
No, because let me put it like this. The sign determines, so there's a this box is in your mind's eye. Suppose you put it on paper and you compute. You will get an answer. It'll have a definite sign. And usually we say, for the leading thing is just the free particle contribution. And that is determined by whether it's a boson or a fermion. But this box, the choice of how you model the box will determine the answer. You want to flip the sign? I'll model the box slightly differently. So there is a conceptual value in drawing the box and saying, look how blind I am. If I take a photograph of this box and a photograph of this box, I can't tell the difference. Bad, good, but I can't tell the difference, okay? That's the point of drawing that box. If there is a physical box, suppose there really is a length scale L that is the graviton's version of the box, okay? What length scale the graviton is assembled as a kind of external particle, some sort of composite or finite-sized particle, like the pion is a particle, a composite particle. Then to that extent, there's a box, but now it's not an imaginary box. There's really some sort of thing playing the role of L. Whatever that theory is will tell you whether the sign of this contribution is positive, negative, et cetera, et cetera. But as I say in this slide, we do not have a concrete model. So I would love the experimentalists to come and find some deviation in Newton's law. And then I'll piece it all together brilliantly. And then I'll tell you everything's going on.
If you have a Hertz violation, what energy scale will happen at? Can one write a variable for scaling amplitude to this?
Again, I gave sort of three distinct stories. They may be related, but I didn't logically relate them. And what you find in these basic estimates for using Lorentz violation to help the vacuum energy problem is you find that, so we did some of these estimates in our paper, but basically you find two things you want to keep track of. One is, where is the Lorentz violation? So there's always two things, right? There's actual physical scales, and then there are small couplings. Okay. So there's actually supposed to be a physical scale not very high in energy from a particle physics point of view, and very high in energy from the collected experimental point of view in this audience. Okay, so it's this mid zone. That's a physical scale where Lorentz invariance might be a big deal. However, when you take into account that gravity is incredibly weak and you convert it into the kind of language where people say, I have bounds which are even super Planck scale on, say, you know, photon speeds of light being different from what relativity says. We went through some of these. I'm now forgetting how to do the estimates very fast. And we found that, by and large, if you just use the absolute limits of these estimates, you sail through those bounds, meaning you're not close to it. Why? Because the as long as gravity is the most affected by this Lorentz violation, and I don't have a UV theory to tell you one way or the other, but if it's gravity that's the most implicated in Lorentz violation, then its corrections on matter tend to be weak, and that tends to make the bounds from matter tests weaker. Again, my advice only is that this is kind of the best case analysis, meaning the safest way to think of these theories. But safe is, you know, nature is not always trying to, if it's using a mechanism, it's not always trying to hide it to the last possible second. So I think one could get lucky by doing Lorentz violation tests. Why I apologize at the beginning of my talk is that I'd rather be giving you sharp milestones, you know, do this, do this, do this. And I cannot honestly do that.
Imagine that is the scale of Lorentz violation in gravity. And imagine that bicep is right, 10 to the 16 GV. So that implies that the creation, basically, during the inflation of gravitons, would not be substantially modified with respect to the standard inflationary scenario. But then you have that the Lorentz breaking scale here is well below 10 to the 16.
Indeed. With the first two stories I told you, it is true that taking bicep at face value, that these ideas, which I would just call loopholes, are hit by the bicep observation. Bicep is this, or tests for gravitational wave, are this end run around all these issues and saying, look, I have much shorter wavelengths I can tell you about. And the only loophole there, I don't know how to gamble, the only loophole there is that any of these scales could evolve with scale factor. And we don't know, since we don't have sharp theories, we don't know whether they do or they don't.
That means that this is lambda UE today.
Exactly.
Maybe the inflation was much
higher. We don't know. That's a logical possibility. In the third story I told you about equivalence principle violation, there it's not the real world, but we can understand even more than just saying I'm throwing up my hands and hoping for the best. Okay.
So we have the last question before the break.
So you were talking about, I think it was the name of the slide before this, was the slide after that, that basically, so you basically said death, right? So what it would look like is that it would look like you just see rays come out of nowhere, right? And we have this GZK limit. If there's any of these things, and maybe you're saying a few MeV, so that's probably not commensurate with right energy scale, but is there any possibility of a connection there?
We hoped so at the time. But then, when we ran the numbers, we said, no. But I hope you get the flavor, after all the apologizing, which took half the talk, that I'm trying to say, I know nothing for sure. My bet would be that GZK is more or less extraordinary ordinary physics. But never say never. But indeed, taken at face value, this is just too infrared to make a difference in GZK. So that's the straight answer.
Okay, now the very last question.
Sorry, can I explain once again why this thing will go sideways?
So I can, if I just plug in this into there.
No, I'm sorry. That looks like the Coulomb law and the plus and minus charges. You know, there's nothing funny happens with plus and minus charges, right? They don't go sideways.
No. There's something worse. The kinetic term is flipped inside. So actually, this is a lovely little mechanics problem. Meaning, all you have to do is plug this in there, and then you find that the cyclic coordinate is not the guy you thought. Normally, it's the center of mass that's cyclic. And the relative coordinate is not, accelerates. Whereas here, it's the other way around.
Right?
Here's the other way around. The relative coordinate is fixed, and the center of mass coordinate.
I suggest we continue at coffee, and we'll come back here in 20 minutes.